Hello, everyone. I'm Chris Larson, reporter for Behavioral Health Business, and you're listening to the BHB Perspectives podcast. Welcome to episode number 12. For this episode of the pod, I sit down with Ocean's Healthcare CEO Jeff Pritchard. He took on that role in May 2022. For the last 15 years or so, Jeff has worked in the hospital leadership space. His career, however, started about 30 years ago as a behavioral health tech in Terre Alta, West Virginia, his home state. Prior to joining Ocean's, he was the COO of Springstone Health, a multi-state behavioral health facility developer and operator, where he managed a P&L of about $500 million. Today, Ocean's Healthcare operates 48 facilities across 9 states and employs about 4,000 people. It focuses on higher acuity services provided by hospitals and similar settings. As we will get into in the conversation, Ocean's Healthcare started off 2025 with a bang, acquiring Nashville-based Haven Behavioral Healthcare. We'll talk about the company's thinking behind that acquisition, its JV strategy, the potential impact of looming Medicaid cuts, and what happens when facilities lose their way culturally. But before we get into that, I want to invite you to join the conversation. Are you interested in participating in one of our in-person or live and recorded digital events? Let me know. You can email me at clarson@wtwhmedia.com or fill out the form I'll link to in the show notes to let us know you're interested. Okay, let's get to my conversation with Jeff Pritchard. Hey there, Jeff. How's it going?
It's going great, Chris. Thank you. Good morning.
Well, thanks for being here. I want to take a couple minutes off the top to get to know you a little bit better. So where are you from?
I am from outside of Morgantown, West Virginia, originally. And grew up in West Virginia, went to WVU, graduated 3 times. It was the best many, many, many years of my life. And live in Ohio now, but make it back home frequently.
Now, what part of the state are you from? I find that if you ask enough questions, just about everybody has some relation to the great state of Ohio.
Yeah, so we are in Ohio. We are we're between Cincinnati and Dayton, so Springboro. Nice area. Came here about 10 years ago or so to run a hospital, and we've stuck around. It's been great to raise our kids, and we like the area. Might my arm get twisted to move somewhere warmer when that last one's out, maybe, but it's a great place to raise a family.
That's fantastic. My wife is from the Cincinnati area. Loved the area. Had nothing really to do with it until I had the chance to meet my wonderful wife, and now constantly in that area in the tri-state. Yeah. Now let's learn a little bit more of where you're working today. What is Ocean's Healthcare? And what does the COO do there?
Yeah, so Ocean's Healthcare is we're a psychiatric hospital company, for lack of a better term. And, we do services at the higher intensity, part of the continuum. So inpatient psychiatric care, partial hospitalization, intensive outpatient. We do a tiny, tiny bit of some clinic work, some low intensity clinic work, but that's what we do. We started in Louisiana. We're about 20 years old as a company, and we started in Louisiana, then Texas, and then we picked up Mississippi and Oklahoma, and we've had some recent acquisition activity. So now we're in 9 states, it's a thriving business for us. I mean, we're doing great things with patients every day and helping folks to get better. What's the COO do? I'm managing the daily operations. That's about as vanilla as it comes, but, I have, some folks, some senior vice presidents who are over various regions. We work with them every day to problem solve everything from clinical issues to working with the legal team if we have a legal issue, HR, and ensuring that again, that people get better, and that we maintain, you know, the profitability that, that our private equity, you know, partners have come to expect. And, you know, it's a fantastic time for Oceans. I mean, there's just lots of growth right now. We have a lot of great people in the company, and it's very exciting.
It definitely is. Behavioral health is probably the most underappreciated, but I think the most compelling space within healthcare right now. Now, I want to learn just a little bit more about you, and hopefully in a way that kind of brings this all together. Ultimately, why are you in behavioral health?
Yeah, it's so I'm a clinician by trade. I've been in the business for 30 years now. I mean, the long story, the Cliff Notes version of the long story is I was in college for English, and thought that I wanted to do something with English. My dad was a coal miner, and he came home one day and said, you know, boy, I've been talking to some guys at the mines, and what do you do with an English degree? And I really didn't know. I had no idea, but it was a lot of fun. And, being in college was a lot of fun. And, you know, had to look around and really decide what I wanted to do. Came upon social work. It was something that sounded interesting. It sounded like there was maybe more potential for me to get, to be employed than maybe in English. And so followed that path a little bit and just loved working with people. Came to appreciate helping people and seeing folks, lots of times come in at their worst and be able to leave, whatever it was, an office or a hospital or whatever, and feel much better. And so I followed that path. I've been in behavioral health. I've done everything from I've been a tech to worked crisis and managed cases and been a therapist, been a lower level manager, worked my way all the way up through those pieces. And, love getting up every morning and doing this work. It's very rewarding, and I wouldn't trade it. So just to be able to see folks go from, those times when they're in the most despair to being able to live in the community successfully is it's a fantastic thing.
Yeah, and that's part of the dynamic that contributes to why I ultimately think behavioral health is one of the most interesting and also one of the most important spaces within all of healthcare, especially today. Now let's shift gears a little bit and talk about Oceans Healthcare in Motion. So some of the latest news from Oceans is the site selection for the, and I'll apologize to everyone involved for any mispronunciations coming up, the Ochsner Behavioral Health Acadiana facility.
Yep.
Did I get that right?
You were ballpark, right?
Ballpark. Okay.
Ochsner and Acadiana. And we're very excited. There's almost a re-announcement here. This has been in the works for a minute. And, about a year and a half ago, we announced something, around this. And now we've dialed in the plan a little more. So we'll do 62 more beds in Lafayette, Louisiana. We have a facility there now, but we'll do 62 more beds. 48 of those are adults, 14 are adolescent, and it will be a JV partnership with Ochsner. And, we partner with them right now, on a JV in Shreveport, Louisiana, with they and LSU. And so this is, more of an extension and, listen, you couldn't pick a better health system to partner with, and in Louisiana, they're fantastic. They do great work. And, this is a great opportunity for us and for them, I think, to bring more services to that Acadiana region.
I gotcha. So let me ask the question this way. So what does the strategy behind doing facility JVs generally look like when it comes to making deals with these local health systems? What does that look like? Why do you guys do that? And in what ways does this particular partnership illustrate that strategy?
Yeah. I think there's there are two pieces of this for us, I think, or two big pieces of this. And one is on the fiscal side, right? You end up with a partner and you defray some of that cost. I think it also, that partnership gets you both invested in behavioral health. You know, you'd mentioned earlier, behavioral health and how important it is. These kind of deals help to bring people to the table and give everybody some ownership in behavioral health, especially when that's not their area of expertise. So, you know, they bring us in as an expert. We go in as an expert. We get a great partner in the community. It defrays the cost a bit. I think it really drives home, you know, we can go together and say, this is important and this is important for the community. We're interested in seeing people get better holistically. Behavioral health is a part of that. And, it just ends up making a lot of sense. We do a lot of these where, you know, we look at, does it make sense to make a JV deal with the fiscal interest of you know, the partner? Or does it make sense to go into this and say, do we look at some kind of a clinical community type partnership and go that route? And we're pretty open to either. You know, when we go into communities, we're pretty open to, you know, tell us what your need is and how we can best get there and, what the partner's comfortable with. Some folks want to, you know, they want a fiscal interest in the business. So we're pretty open either way.
So what do these joint ventures look like from the operation side? Like who's calling the shots kind of on a daily basis? Who sets the strategy? And a good example of illustrating this is like who's actually in charge of hiring the staff to make sure that the thing actually runs and works. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, it's so we're in charge of the operation. There's a board that we sit and our partner sits on this JV board, and we're involved in setting strategy and looking at some things together. Do we add more beds? Do we deliver this service? And I think it's a great forum for where can that partner help you a little bit. Food costs are through the roof. You know, the way we're doing it now, you know, is there a way that the partner can help defray that? Can we run meals through their cafeteria and make this work better? So, you know, there's a lot of working together, in that sense. But we run the day-to-day. We hire the people, in all of our JVs. And some people do this differently, but in all of our JVs right now, we have the controlling interest. But we've never really had to come back to that. You know, we've got good enough partnerships that, you know, you sit at the table and you're partners and you work through solutions together and you come up with the way the business is going to look together. And that's kind of what's got us through these.
I gotcha. Now let's shift gears a little bit to talk another aspect about how Ocean's Healthcare grows and is growing. Mm-hmm. Y'all started off 2025 with a pretty big announcement, and that was the acquisition of Haven Behavioral Healthcare, especially after a year where deal-making was a little stuck. Little context from researching and looking back on that deal announcement. It's increased Ocean's footprint to 48 facilities in 9 states and about 4,000 employees. So there's a lot of need that you can address with like your JVs or even just going on your own doing de novo. So why tackle an M&A?
Yeah, you know, it was interesting. You and I talked, I think, Chris, about 3 years ago when I came over, we did an interview. But I tell people this is kind of a funny story. My first day, I fly from Cincinnati down to Plano, Texas, to the headquarters, and I come in the building, and Mandy Miller, who's part of our exec team, says to me, "Hey, don't unpack everything, because you guys are getting on a plane and going to Nashville in the morning." It's like my first day. And I go, "Okay, I mean, what are we doing?" And she says, "You're going to talk to Haven folks." It was 3 years ago. Haven had started in their process back then. And so we did. We went to Nashville, met with their team, really loved everybody that we talked to. Didn't get a deal done. And that happens sometimes. And, we kind of missed it. And boy, we hated it. We hated we didn't get it done. They continued through their process. Got close again, to a deal and didn't quite get there. And we got another bite at the apple. And, I mean, for us, it made sense on a lot of levels. I mean, it took us from being a regional player, you know, a pretty big region with four states that you know, we're in, but really to, you know, to being a national player. And what it allows us to do is to kind of take those, you know, those areas where Haven has hospitals and spider out a bit, you know, spider web out a little bit from there and begin to explore other areas of the country that we'd like to be in, you know, as we kind of link some of these places together instead of, you know, just having a, you know, a one-off somewhere that's hard to get to or that we don't have other avenues to support. So it made a lot of sense for us. Loved their product. They had managed, you know, pretty well and loved their people. Why do the M&A? De novos are expensive right now. They take a long time. You know, money's expensive. Labor's expensive. Materials are expensive. You know, when you're building something new, you know, the permitting and the drawing and all those other things just take time. So for us to be able to pick up, you know, nearly 500 bids in one fell swoop, you know, was just a no-brainer, especially with a company that we really liked.
And that all makes a lot of sense. Now let's talk about what happens next. So from the COO chair, what is the biggest issue that you try to solve for while bringing a company like Oceans and Haven together, other than cultural fit? We're going to talk about that specifically in a minute. But okay. Other than cultural fit, like, what are the biggest things that you got to solve for when you unite companies like this?
Synergies. You know, you've got one of these, we've got one of these. Do we need two of these? You know, do we synergize that down a bit? And you know, in this kind of a deal, that's always a consideration, right? Is you know, let's get this thing right sized. That's the first big thing, I think. You know, aside from cultural fit, you know, how do we get this thing right-sized and efficient and, you know, maintain the effectiveness of the whole platform now? So that's one piece. I think when I look at other things, it's ownership of things. You know, it's we've got a great process. You've got a great process. They're a little different. You know, how do we arrive at something that works for, you know, what we've had, what you've got? And I think you really have to look sometimes and you have to go into this with a very open mind. Because I think you look and you say, God, we've done it this way for X number, you know, for the last 12 years. But when you look, you go, man, I kind of like what they do. Could we adapt that? And so I think there's a lot of that right now, where folks have to kind of check their egos and open their minds and work with one another and go, you know, let's keep this that we have and bring you on, but let's do what you're doing and we'll adapt to that. Those are the big challenges right now. And I think there's also just the piece of learning new markets. You know, that's the other big thing is, you know, what does it look like in this market? Tell us who the players are. You know, with what we've had over the years, I mean, we know our markets very well, but, you know, these are new faces, new places for us.
Right. And even hearing in that answer, you know, there's a certain demonstration there of how inescapable cultural aspects are within companies. But, you know, I've got to tell you, I get a little nauseated every time I hear people talking about cultural alignment or cultural fit or similar terms, because it feels like that's shorthand or it's coded or loaded to get in the way of what people really mean. So at least from the Ocean's point of view, what does cultural fit or alignment really mean?
Yeah, I think for us, and I don't disagree with you at some level. I mean, I get the same thing where I go, all right, let's get past that. And you know, I think there's a simplification that is, no matter the culture, we've still got the body of work that we have to complete, sure. Right? And you know, culture for us is, you know, when I came here 3 years ago, I had, you know, there were lots of things that I looked around at. This is where I wanted to be. And part of that was I really liked the people. I really believe that the people at Oceans were here to help people first and foremost. That you know, this was a company that cared about people. And 3 years later, I can tell you, you know, for once in my life, I was spot on with my assessment. You know, folks have been fantastic. So I think for us, culture is about integrity. It's about compassion. it's about accountability, you know, and I mean, those are the kind of things, you know, we have the Ocean 6 principles that we believe in. They're very important to us. So it's I don't know, it gets a little fancy in the description sometimes, but at the end of the day, we want to work with people that care about people. We want to work with people who can respect one another. We don't want to work with jerks, you know, every day. And we don't. We make real sure that we're hiring people that you know, got good hearts and good heads. And we believe that's what makes us very successful.
I think that's a good way to put it. So at least keeping on the line of conversation with deal making, is Ocean's going to be announcing any more deals in 2025?
Boy, I hope. We're certainly looking at lots of stuff. I think you do the big deal to start the year and now it's what do you tuck in here that makes more sense. And I think that's really what we're looking at, you know, right now is what are those things that make sense to tuck into this platform now? There's a lot out there right now. You know, there are a lot of folks that want to have conversations and hope that, you know, 25 is a great year for deals. And I think with some changes, you know, with power and the elections and you know, folks maybe think that things will pick up. And I hope we're talking about some other big things as we get into the back half.
I gotcha. And kind of a real quick footnote, but I do want to talk about it, at least for the deal-making part of this conversation, but also for the Haven acquisition. Yesterday, we learned about the announcement about Comvest Partners providing a $273 million senior credit facility. In the announcement about that, at least part of that, if not most of it, is tied to the deal. The reason I bring that up is because it shows that you guys are able to do this and actually get it done, convince you know, a third party that you're worth the bet, as it were. You're worth the money. But what else can we learn about this particular credit facility? What else is there to say about you guys working still with Comvest, who's been a partner of yours for a while?
Yeah, and I think that's the important piece, Chris, is they have been a partner for a while. We need to have enough money on hand to go after, you know, other things too. You know, part of this is deal and part of this is, you know, we want to be able to go to the table with folks and have them understand that we have the wherewithal to pull the next deal off if we're having those conversations. So, you know, they're a lender. We work very well with them. We appreciate their partnership. To your point, yeah, it's fantastic that, you know, that they're bullish enough on our business and on our performance to continue to partner with us. And, you know, certainly that's, you know, it's a significant investment and, you know, it puts us in a good place to continue to be active in the space.
Understood. Now we're going to need to shift to some more kind of current events topics. And we're going to need to break from normal conversational format for me to give at least a little bit of context to at least the wider news around the situation. So we're going to talk about Medicaid potential cuts there and what those impacts might be. This is a very fluid situation right now. So even by the time this gets put together and this comes out, what we're talking about might be a couple of days out of date. So I want to give listeners that quick context. But at least as of the time of the recording, we're waiting for the reconciliation of the House resolution and the Senate resolution. And the House resolution there is a provision that the committee that oversees Medicare, Medicaid, and other stuff cuts $880 billion out of their budget. Now, it doesn't say explicitly that they have to cut this out of Medicare or Medicaid. But that being said, yesterday we got a letter from the Congressional Budget Office that if you were to take out stuff that's not related to Medicaid outlays, you would still be left with 93% of their budget, meaning that 93% of the roughly $88 trillion that they account for the 10-year budget period in 2025 to 2034 is Medicaid. So if this group is going to have to go back after reconciling the budget resolution and make cuts, there's no other way around it. So what would cuts like this do to Oceans and its patients?
Yeah, it's a great question, and you're right. It's very fluid. We are in some markets that quite honestly are pretty rural. We're in some parts of the country that maybe are poorer parts. You know, I feel like part of the ocean's mission has been to serve those most in need or those most underserved. And that puts us in a lot of areas where Medicaid is the primary payer. So it would hurt us. We would have to go back and look at things and kind of determine what are the next steps for us, depending on what happens. I think the big part in the question you ask is, what's it do to our patients? And that's the fear, is that, this really could be disastrous for a lot of people. When they look at the care they need day in, day out to exist in the community, that would be the big fear, is that, this would take a lot of that care away. And we'd have a lot of questions that we'd have to help answer about how you deliver that and how you pay for that and how we stay solvent and relevant and all those other things. We're fairly diversified in our pay mix. I mean, that's not the only thing we have in our platform. So we're fairly diversified, but it's important.
Yeah, and I want to drill down just a little bit more on the, going back and looking at things part of your answer. So with something as big and as sweeping as a readjustment of the levels of funding that the federal portion of Medicaid gets, which is in a lot of states most of it, 90% in the expansion states, what would Ocean's Healthcare have to reconsider? Like, we're talking about impacts of patients. If ultimately you get a steep slash to what reimbursement could be associated with services for a Medicaid patient, what do you do?
Yeah, I mean, well, I think the hard thing for us, it's a great question. I wish I had a great answer. I guess right now the answer is I don't know until we see what they cut, right?
Good point, yeah.
Is the cut to rates, do they sweep some rate cuts across this thing? Do they cut services, fully? Do they take X service and say, we're not going to pay for that at all anymore? I think we'd have to find out what those things are, right? And then you go, all right, what do we need to juggle here? Do we continue to do service X if the rate gets cut? Can we afford to do that? Maybe, maybe not. If you take away a whole service line, what do we have to flip to, if anything, right? So I think really we're kind of in that place where we're like everybody else. We're waiting to see what this thing ends up shaping out to. I think the things we hear that sound like they're fairly certain are, we're apt to see some work requirements. We're apt to see more attention to fraud, waste, and abuse. Outside of that, it seems like we can't get a good consensus on what everybody thinks. We've talked about a million people, and everybody's got a little different idea of what they think is going to happen. Those, though, tend to be the two themes that are pretty consistent, to a man. So we're going to have to wait and see. I hope this isn't. I hope this is well thought out. I hope that and you can talk about things like work requirements. I hope I hope it takes into account that we've got some folks that may not be as able to work as others. Fraud, waste, abuse. I mean, listen, man, nobody wants to play with folks that are dirty in the space, right? So I think that's great. But we're going to have to wait and see.
And this isn't so much a question, but if you do have a reaction, I'd love to hear it. On top of the uncertainty that you see at the federal level with developing these cuts, you now have, once that happens, you multiply the work that organizations like yours have to do times 50 with each state, probably taking a different tact in reaction to the cut to the funding that they're ultimately going to receive from the federal government to administer that program. Sure, Medicaid is jointly administered by the federal government and the state governments. But it's 50 plus different programs across American states and territories. So I can only imagine having to try to figure that out. Granted, you're not in all 50 states. You got to worry about your states.
No, it's you're right. And with the acquisition even, right? Even with the acquisition, us picking up, Pennsylvania, Ohio, New Mexico, Arizona, Idaho, we pick up five states. Just the amount of work to look at these five states and go, hey, what's different in those is a lot, right? Mm-hmm. So to your point, it would be just a ton of stuff. And, you know, there's always that piece in here where you go, and then it'll be time to start over again with a new administration, right? And that's kind of the nature of it. I think the thing we do know is right, this is one term. And so something's going to change again, so I don't know. You hope the changes aren't so sweeping that about the time we figure it out and get done that we're back into completely re-engineering this system again. I mean, that's, I don't know. That's a wish from me. I'm not sure anybody's listening to that, but that's what I wish for is that this, this is pretty, this is pretty close to the vest, that it impacts as few of our patients as possible, that it's something that we can adjust to, that it's fair. Those are the hopes.
I gotcha. And at least expressing those hopes, in a public setting, what kind of advocacy work is Oceans involved with these days?
Yeah, it's one of the great things when I came here and Stuart Archer, our CEO, is just involved in all kinds of stuff, when it comes to advocacy. And that was one of the real cool things for me was, listen, I can go and focus on operations and do that piece. And he's out there, advocating on behalf of patients and providers. And we do a lot of stuff. We certainly have lobbyists everywhere. We dig into the legislative side of this everywhere. So, we've helped to sponsor bills. We've been successful in that. We started, the Texas Association of Behavioral Health Providers. So that was something last year that was a big deal where we brought in, all of the private psych providers in Texas, really to push for better care for patients and better rates for providers. I mean, it's been forever, since we've seen that in Texas. And listen, I think we're making, I think we're making some headway there. Hopefully that continues to move in a positive fashion. We advocated in Mississippi, for supplemental payments and relief and we're successful there. We've got a couple states right now, one where we're pushing coverage of the PHP benefit. The state doesn't provide that in their plan right now. We've got another state where we're advocating for an IOP benefit. They actually do provide for PHP, but not IOP. So, I think we have just a whole lot of things we're involved in, where we see an issue in one of these nine states and go, listen, this is really important to the business. It's important to patients. It's important to us as the provider. And it's important to peers we have in the space. I think that's the other thing that Stuart has done quite well. Is trying to pull others, our peers and competitors, I guess you could say too, but they're peers, but trying to pull them into this with us and say, hey, let's go advocate together. We have strength together and let's see how far we can go and what we can get done. So some exciting stuff out there, as we're in these legislative sessions.
Yeah, I hear you loud and clear, and it's quite an unfortunate example, but an example, nonetheless, these Medicaid cuts, when it comes to the big time pressure that a lot of psychiatric hospitals and other facility based forms of treatment in behavioral health care face right now. I've covered this a little bit, had the chance to talk with folks at Oceans and some of your peer organizations to articulate what the challenges are, and they're immense. So why does Oceans Healthcare operate in this space? And maybe in other words, why not pivot to something else?
Well, that's what we do. It's interesting and I don't know that a lot of people know this about Oceans. We've been around 20 years. One of the two founders of Oceans still works for us. He's the guy that is in charge of the Louisiana and Mississippi region. And Nick Guillory is a great guy and has stuck around for all these years. And this is what we do. I mean, this is the business we chose. you know, there's a group of folks out there that you know, behavioral health is very important. It's also very misunderstood. It's also pushed to the back burner. It's what we do. Would we pivot and do something different? Would we add to the to what we do? Potentially, I think. But you know, for us, I mean, you know, somebody's got to keep doing this every day. There are still people in need. They still need beds. They still need PHPs, IOPs, med management, counseling. You know, whatever those things are. I don't know. I don't have a great answer other than this is what we do, man. And we love it. And we kind of own that mission. And, you know, we're very careful. We've had a lot of things, you know, that since I've been here over the last 3 years that we've looked at that we go, yeah, this is a cool thing, but it's not exactly right down the fairway of what we do. So does that become a distraction for us? Right. And I think, you know, we've had to be real careful in, you know, what we've chosen, and we've had to leave some things, you know, behind, you know, that I've looked at and went, oh man, that would be really cool. You know, that would be a real neat thing for us to be involved in, but it's not us, you know? So I think we love behavioral health, and, I feel like we're good at it. I feel like we have 4,000 plus people who just love people, and you know, we're going to find a way to be successful through whatever happens, and we're gonna do that in the behavioral health space.
Absolutely, and finding the way to be successful no matter what happens also has to take into account the reality and the evolution of the industry generally.
Yeah.
Now, I want to, with this next question, we're going to take the focus off of Ocean specifically and go big picture with the industry. Are psychiatric hospitals less relevant in America today than they were any number of years ago? And one of the reasons that I bring that up is because even hearing and learning about your hearing in your answers about PHPs, IOPs, those are wonderful settings, but one of the key purposes of the PHP IOP setting is to make sure that people don't need to get to the psychiatric hospital in the first place. Do you hear what I'm saying? So like what, like are they less relevant today than in the past?
I don't think so. Okay. And here's what I'll tell you, you know, when I started my career in behavioral health, I was, I did about 15 years in community mental health, and people would, you know, people ask you to kind of boil that down. You know, what are you doing in behavioral health? You keep people out of hospitals, right? And then there came the point in my career where I flipped over and became a hospital guy. And if you boil it down there, people go, what do you try to do as a hospital guy? You try to keep people out of hospitals. I mean, it's still the mission, right? We still all want to maintain people in the community. But there is a reality that no, hospitals aren't diminished. There's always going to be this base level of need with these hospitals because of the acuity of the things we treat, right? And you know, when we talk about PHP and IOP, we're talking about what can prevent you from going into the hospital, but also we're talking about what you can step down to that keeps you out of the hospital, right? What we know is this. What we can all agree on in behavioral health is this, and there are very few things that we all agree on, right? We like to fuss and fight, but what we all agree on and the research points to is the longer you're engaged in treatment to a point, right? There is a point of diminishing returns, but the longer you're engaged in treatment, the better your chance of success, right? So a lot of that starts with that 5, 6, 7 day stay in inpatient where we stabilize, and then we step down to a couple weeks of PHP where we really start to solidify some of that, but we still got you a long time. And then we step you down to IOP where you're there a little longer, but for less time per day and less days per week. And then you step to the community. That is the magic behind behavioral health. And if we do that, we keep people out of hospitals. But what I've seen in my career is there's still always somebody there who needs that bed, even though we've been successful with Joe or Mary and they're doing well in the community. There's somebody else at that door who needs that bed that you know, that we've got to work through. I mean, deinstitutionalization took a lot of beds out of the system. You know, a lot of state beds are now tied up in forensics, right? So no, we still, we're very full. Our competitors are very full. we're all still building, buying, beds, trying to get back to a level. It's almost like there was an over rotation at some point on closing beds. Yeah. When I was in West Virginia, we had a state hospital that had, at its peak, 1200 patients. And we replaced that with a state hospital that had 150 patients. That's quite the drop.
Yeah. And, as the kids say, the math ain't mathin'.
That's right. Well, and people say, well, community service, right? So, but what you tell me is, we had all these people who'd been maintained in state hospitals. And I remember this as a young guy in behavioral health. Suddenly, we were in that area where that state hospital is located, and all of these people came to the community. And I thought we were pretty darn good at community services, but man, we weren't prepared for that. And I think that's kind of what you get into right now, is everybody likes to talk about community services, but they're still not adequate to the point that you wouldn't need beds.
Yeah, I hear you loud and clear. I mean, some part of the cause of that goes back to the phenomenon you reflected on when we were talking about the changing in funding levels for Medicaid. We'll go through this process, there'll be a change in administration, and we might have to be looking at another reworking of policy when it comes to Medicaid funding. And, part of the reason why either there aren't enough or a certain level of community services is because of a really inconsistent level of attention given to those community services to make up for whatever was lost or displaced by the closure of some of these hospitals.
That's right. No, it's exactly right. And listen, think about when all that happened and how far, listen, I don't want to be, how far we've not come, right? And I don't want to be overly negative. I think in a lot of ways we've come a long way, and what's out there is much better than it was, back in the day. But there's a reality that is, 30 years later, we've still not figured it all the way out. I think for us, it's that continuum, and I think for us, as we go into the future, it's that continuum. It's how do we maintain those beds, add where we see need in a community where there may not be enough, but how do we expand those outpatient programs to help more and more people and let them enter the system potentially at a point that's not at that highest level of acuity. What we hope is somebody enters the system and they can enter in IOP, maybe, and then get shuffled right back down to the community and never have to go up the stairs, to those higher intensity services. That's what you want. Those are continuums that communities can be proud of. And I think this is what we're trying to build in places, where we operate.
Absolutely. And, what you're speaking here is you're speaking the truth, and that's not negative at all. Telling the truth about what's going on around us helps us get going on where we want to be going. Another part of the just truth of healthcare, and it's sad to say, but sometimes people get hurt in healthcare. What's worse, sometimes people hurt people. A lot of what people like to single out when that happens are the for-profit operators in both hospital space and behavioral health space when this stuff happens. And, in your experience, is that fair?
Sometimes, we all see some of these things that are in the news, not necessarily lately behavioral health related. There have certainly been things, other things that have been out there in the acute space. Sometimes, we go back to that culture question, right? Why is culture so important? Culture is so important so you don't end up there, right? I think there has to be, for me, at the end of the day, in the for-profit space, and that's what we are, and there's no shame in that, proud of that. But at the end of the day, culture becomes important because we can't lose sight of, we're here to first and foremost to get people better, keep people safe, right? Mm-hmm. If we're doing those two things, the profits will come, and we know that, right? I think where you end up in a danger zone is when people forget those things and they go straight to the money, and they're more interested in how do I make X instead of how do I keep people safe, get people better. And so, you know, for us, I think that's the culture, right? That's the culture that Haven had coming in. That's the culture we had that you know, made sense is let's focus on patients first and the other will come and let's hold each other accountable to that.
And it comes back to the supremacy of culture yet again in this conversation, yeah, but also the big picture.
Know, yeah, I mean, and I didn't mean to bring it back there, Chris.
But no, listen, it's fine.
It is. It's just such a big part in this question, right? In that question, it matters. I mean, these people have lost their way a little bit when you see those things in the news, when you see people getting hurt, when you see organizations being hurt, communities being hurt. You know, I can't help but to look at that and go, that is an organization that somewhere lost its way. People forgot this, right? They forgot this most important piece of being involved in healthcare, which is we take care of people first and foremost, right? If you're not doing that, all that other stuff doesn't matter. And so, you know.
Well, and based on what you just shared, I think I know the answer to this question, but I need to ask it anyway. I mean, would care quality at Ocean's Healthcare be any better, worse, different if it were a nonprofit organization?
I guess what I would say is I'm not sure, you know, I worked nonprofit for many years, and loved it. Right. I guess I'm not sure where it makes it better in our instance, right. When I look at us and I think about us and I go, yeah, we're a for-profit entity, but man, you know, we're taking a lot and reinvesting in our people. And in our communities and in our buildings and all those things. And, you know, to me, if you're doing that, the for-profit, nonprofit question becomes somewhat irrelevant, right? You go, nah, man, we're putting our money back into the business, back into the people, back into the patients. So, no, I don't think it'd make a difference here. I mean, I think we're doing the right things.
Yeah, and, you know, the funny thing about any of these hospitals, regardless of the tax or tax exemption status, is that if they don't actually generate a profit, they don't get to exist very long. So,
no, I mean, not around, right? I mean, there's a fiscal management piece that is just pretty basic that says, hey, if you're not responsible, you know, if you're not fiscally, you know, accountable, it ain't going to matter anyway. You're not going to be here. And that's what you see in the news with a lot of these places. And you see more than, you know, I read the news, you're part of the, you know, the compiling the news, but I see this every day where it just didn't work, right? People, they mismanaged. And, I don't know. I feel grateful that I'm part of an organization that again, we hold each other accountable. There are lots of bells and whistles. There are lots of cool things that we'd like to have. There are lots of programs we'd like to start. Or we hold each other accountable here, though. And, you know, that's not about for-profit. That's just about fiscal accountability to accountability to one another.
I gotcha. And we're starting to wind down here a little bit. Just a few more questions to go through before I let you go. I am curious when it comes to that fiscal management, fiscal responsibility. I mean, are facilities like this, these hospitals, are they innately and easily profitable?
Boy, I wish.
You wish. Okay.
Yeah. No. I mean, innately and easily, no. You know, we have to do a lot of work. You know, you have to look at these and you know, these aren't big margins, you know, in the grand scheme of things. I think there are some states that are better than others and more easily profitable, you know, where the rates are higher and maybe they're a little more progressive in what they pay. And so that makes it better. But no, we really have to, you know, we're a one-line service for, you know, lack of a better term. You go to an acute care hospital and, you know, I got ortho and I got, you know, I'm doing, you know, heart stuff down here, you know, I've got a cath lab over here and we got inpatient, right? That's what we got. And we got these two outpatient service lines and none of these are get rich rates. People have become more expensive. The rates have not followed suit, which I think is where a lot of our advocacy efforts come in. No, we really have to work, and our operators have to be very responsible, and they are. They're fantastic. I mean, they're fantastic people. And man, they're looking at this and they're looking at how do I save? And, you know, I think when you bring on a Haven, you go, what does that ever save you any money? Yeah, the synergies, but also, you know, do we get some volume pricing on things that can drive down this cost and push that margin up a little bit? But this is, it's not a complicated business. I would say it's not the most complicated business, but man, it is a hard business. And, you know, we have to, we have to work every day. You know, we have to work every day. Our operators have to work every day to keep this thing on the rails like it should be.
I got you. And last question for you. Am I going to see you at New Orleans at our event Value here in a couple of weeks?
We usually send the pretty people to public things. You know, we save us, you know, we ugly bald guys, you know.
Speak for yourself.
These things. So I'm sure we will be well represented. I'm not there, but listen, I'm sure we're going to be well represented by the beautiful people.
Awesome, Jeff. Well, thank you so much for making time for us. We'll catch you around next time.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you so much for joining us on the BHB Perspectives podcast. And now I have a question for you. Will I see you in New Orleans on March 20th and 21st for Value 2025? My fellow journalists and I will be leading several conversations about the latest developments in value-based care and other reimbursement-related innovations. You can buy tickets on our website. And remember, BHP Plus members get a discount on tickets. I look forward to seeing you there. I'm Chris Larson, reporter for Behavioral Health Business. I'll see you next time.